Welcome to Positive Change, a Bateswells podcast exploring the outcomes of an unprecedented year for the charity sector.
Hello, I'm Lisa Ramrekar. I'm a freelance journalist and the author of Positive Change, the outcomes of an unprecedented year. Today, I'd like to welcome our two guests, Jim Minton, who's chief executive of Toynbee Hall, a community organisation based in London's East End for the past 130 years, supporting people experiencing poverty and giving them a platform to shape change. Our other guest is Erica Crump, who's a partner at Bates Wells. She works with charities and social enterprises, particularly with a focus on culture and the heritage sector. Really wanted to have a talk to our two guests today to find out what sort of innovative work has been going on to improve the work that they're doing on the ground. I wanted to ask Jim first to tell us a little bit more about your experience, Jim, of what's been happening at Toynbee Hall and the wider sector that you're involved with in London.
It's been a really, really hard period for everyone, particularly organisations within communities who've had to bear not only the challenge of kind of supporting people in real need and with huge anxieties and with huge challenges themselves around their own health and their well-being and their financial worries, but also I think dealing with the challenges that our own teams and volunteers are facing, because, you know, we're all ordinary people with families and our own pressures, and the fact that we and many, many other organisations are still here and are still together and talking about, well, how do we try and recover, is actually a really good thing in that context and shows us the resilience of organisations in all of the kind of anxieties and the challenges. There's been some really good examples that we can build upon, I think, to make positive change. I think people have been less territorial. There's a real kind of can-do or kind of must-do spirit about things. And I think we've certainly felt that, you know, ourselves and other organisations where you might have been kind of competing for things before, or actually thinking, no, hang on, we've all just got to get on and do this. And everyone always likes to say that the community and the people who rely on you come first. But actually, this has genuinely been the case, especially because so many of us have been affected ourselves as well. So it's been a hard period, but you know, with lots of positive things to think about as well.
Erica, that just picking up on Jim's point about organisations working together and not competing in the same way that they did, I just wondered what your experience has been with the clients that you're working with.
So I've seen a lot of interesting work and innovation amongst my clients and also just organisations that I work with or have a relationship with. I've been really impressed by organisations that have had to suffer really drastic change. Obviously, I'm very close to the cultural sector, having your entire building, public space closed, and yet still being really innovative to try and find some ways to communicate with beneficiaries and the public has been amazing to see. I've also been really buoyed by the smaller organisations that have clubbed together to pivot. And I've seen a lot of that through deciding to do more things digitally. I saw a group of around 100 smaller organisations form a collaboration to allow them to do what they've always done, but through digital means, and to not be swamped and pushed out by the larger players. And all of that was done within the matter of months earlier on in the lockdown. So I found that so encouraging to sort of see that, let's stop what we were doing, let's pivot, and let's try something new.
Can you tell us a bit more about that project? It sounds like something that I think our listeners would like to hear a bit more about.
It was a group of independent galleries. They lost their very business overnight. They can't go to art fairs, they can't deal in the way that they used to, and they can't welcome people over the threshold. So they had to think about digital. And my understanding of the digital art sector is that it is very dominated by some of the big players. So that idea of galleries coming together, setting up a new nonprofit, working collaboratively, and crucially agreeing that they would share a platform, but also knowledge and data, and which is, you know, something that they might have protected more closely before, is amazing. And it happened so quickly. And I was just really, really happy to witness that.
I really like that example, Erica, and I agree. I think that's one of the things that has been in the spirit of that kind of can do and breaking down barriers. We work with about 20 organisations across London providing face-to-face debt advice. Now, of course, you know, when the lockdown happened back last March, you couldn't do face-to-face advice anymore. And it was incredible how quickly that was turned around into online and kind of phone service. And since Christmas, we've introduced now a 24-hour helpline for people needing debt advice in London. I think that's the first one in the country. And, you know, things that organisations probably have talked about for a long time and thought, oh, we really wish we could do that. We really wish we could offer people appointments out of hours, but it's kind of really hard. And that actually suddenly that stuff has become not just possible, but absolutely essential, and everyone's managed to do it. And organisations like ours with spaces, we had a food distribution centre for refugees and people with no recourse to public funds who were hugely disadvantaged. And that was a really great thing to do. The kind of challenges is, as ever, there are always going to be people who miss out. We were talking to some members of the community last week about digital exclusion, and it's brilliant the fact that people have been able to provide them with tablets and IT support and whatever else to get online, but some of the practice still hasn't changed. You know, some were telling stories about how difficult it is, even if they can get an online appointment with their GP, for example, actually things like privacy are much more difficult, things like who might be listening, things like kind of ability to use the technology and things like that is hard. So there's been loads of good things, I agree, but there's lots of learning, and there's still some kind of really big systemic barriers that we have to focus on and try and break down.
What about the partnership and collaboration with local government? Because I know that some charities have really thrived in this area, and you know, and the feedback has been that it's been an easier relationship than pre-pandemic. I just wondered whether you had any thoughts on that.
Tower Hamlets is our local authority, and that they've worked incredibly hard. But I understand that many local authorities have as well, to change the nature of communication with the sector. And actually, everyone historically has always talked about partnerships and collaboration between local authority and charities. And you know, many people will say, "Oh, it's been hard previously." But actually, for example, the mayor of Tower Hamlets has a monthly Teams meeting with representatives from across the voluntary sector. There's usually about 50 or 60 people there. And it's a very open discussion. It's a very collaborative discussion about what's happening in the borough, what things that the local authority are doing, what things that charities are doing, what needs to change as a result of it. They've been really good at trying to protect funding. And the same has been, you know, the way that the Greater London Authority has approached things. They've really tried to think, okay, if we're going to have an agenda and we're going to have a kind of set of priorities around this, let's try and make sure that civil society and the voluntary sector is involved. But, you know, it hasn't been perfect, and there are still as many organisations who are rightly worried about whether or not they do really fit in with this agenda and how it's going to work and whether their voices are being heard. But I think there have been some really good examples, and in London particularly, the kind of idea of local authorities, the GLA and civil society more broadly coming together to try and shape recovery has been a positive step forward, I think.
I would just add to that a lot of our clients who work with local government have said that in some areas it's been quicker to get things done, you know. And I've heard that and witnessed that with central government as well, that they have really moved at speed at times, particularly the DfE in relation to early learning, or DCMS and Arts Council with their funding of the cultural sector. And I've seen a real will from the civil servants to move things along and get money out of the door quickly or create access quickly. And that's been really encouraging.
The recent budget wasn't great news for the sector, but it did bring a few things that leaders have kind of been quite cheerful about, I think. But one of them was the announcement that community groups will be able to bid for match funding to buy local assets. And I just wondered whether you think that is a good opportunity at this moment, or whether there may be still some obstacles to charities actually taking advantage of that.
I love the idea of community ownership, and I did quite a lot of work with the library sector in the past, and there were some success stories there. I just love the principle of taking over your pub or your playing fields or a community asset that really means something to local people, and who better to do it. The slight fly in the ointment for me is the matched funding point, which is just that matched funding, you know, it's difficult to raise your own funds, and that immediately prejudices people who don't have any background in fundraising. And it would have been great if the matched funding had kicked in after a certain amount, so you could apply for some seed funding to help you with the fundraising, because if you can access just a little bit of expertise in fundraising, it can get you a long way. And so I can see that being a block, along with other things like, you know, liability and risk and insurance, but hopefully some communities will take it up.
I think that's right. I think it's a very positive thing. It builds on the back of the kind of community asset transfer rules that were already in place. There are some challenges. Again, I'm sorry if I don't mean to sound too London-centric, but in London there has been a challenge because of just the price of land. And even if you make things available to community ownership, actually often you end up competing with developers and it's just really, really difficult. We're in a fortunate position. We do own our assets, and we just before lockdown, in fact, we finished a really significant development creating a community garden and shared space and event space and space for co-creation and things like that. And we were very, very fortunate, and I would absolutely welcome, you know, efforts to give more organisations that kind of opportunity. But I think that there probably has to be some more kind of structural consideration about that. You know, it's one thing being able to get the assets. It's another thing being able, as Erica said, to raise the money, but also to be able to kind of compete in a very competitive environment, particularly in London for land. So it's a challenge. But there were other positive things in the budget. The Chancellor announced that there would be a no interest loan scheme, which is a bit of a kind of technical thing, but it's something that's aimed at people who can't get access to credit, but nevertheless credit might be useful. And it's early days and it's going to be a pilot, but it is something that communities that we've worked with and others have worked with who are indebted or who have got financial health challenges have been saying for a long time. And, you know, we were really pleased that eventually that those voices from the community have kind of bubbled up and the government has listened and there is going to be some progress on that. It's a challenging picture for everyone. And I think everyone is worried about how the economy is going to play out and that there isn't enough being done yet to kind of close the gap between those who've suffered the most and those who have resources. As organisations, we have to keep on coming up with kind of positive solutions and voices of the community and arguing for change for making sure that people don't lose out.
Yeah. I just wondered what you both thought of, given that there are so many opportunities bubbling up, what the role of the board needs to be at the moment for charities and, you know, sort of what extra skilling up might be needed, or whether there's maybe a bit of a change of mindset with some organisations who may have been a bit less open to taking risks or working with other organisations going into partnerships.
I was really reflecting on this last night, actually, because frankly, I think a lot of boards, well, in general and with the collaboration, may feel one or two steps removed from it. But I do actually think the board and the committees of the board have a real role to play. Partly it's just changing the culture. So organisations that are going to start working in new ways and quickly building relationships with different types of businesses or other charities or social enterprises, it does take a leap of faith for boards. And I think they need to not be too scared about getting it wrong. And then there's also just that thing that as trustees, we are often sort of instinctively protective of our own organisation and potentially competitive and maybe just a bit cautious around sharing and being open to real partnership working and maybe even making contact with that other board that you're going to go into partnership or that other stakeholder group. I think that the best examples of long-term collaborations are ones where the board really buys into it and on even a personal level will take part in that partnership way of working rather than standing back from it. And I speak as a trustee as well when I say that. I think it's really important to embrace that. But I'd be interested to hear what Jim thinks about that.
I agree with a lot of that. Time before we just finished recruiting for like six new trustees at the beginning of 2020. And the reason for that was we had some vacancies, but we also realised that, you know, we needed new skills on the board. We particularly needed a board that was more diverse and more drawn from the community around us and had real experience of the local area because we're a place-based organisation, and that we managed to get some really good people in. And of course, the minute we got them in, it was like, oh no, all hands on deck. You know, we're having to deal with this enormous crisis that nobody could have predicted and nobody quite knew how it was going to pan out. And genuinely, like everyone was, I'm sure, asking us questions about, wow, what kind of organisation is going to be able to survive this? How are you going to come out the other end? And our trustees have been fantastic and incredibly supportive. And actually, probably got much more involved in the operations of the organisation than maybe usually governance boards would do. To that spirit of kind of everyone needing to look in together, that was very much the case. And so it's been a really good learning experience for us, and realising take on these people to be your trustees, because I'm sure you are as well, Erica, because they're incredibly talented and bring a lot of kind of insights and things. And then all you ever do with them is once every quarter ask them to look at your finances and kind of agree your risk register and things. You think, well, actually, it's much more valuable to work with them as collaborators and partners. And so that's been great experience. The things about risk and about partnerships, I agree with. And I think our trustees, in understanding the organisation better, I think are much more willing and interested in helping us think about the kinds of partnerships we have, whether those are kind of delivery partnerships with other charities, or whether they're, as I said before, we've got wonderful spaces here at Toynbee Hall, how we share those and involve others in them. I think the caveat on the risk is we're still, and as trustee, and a trustee myself, I know this, we're still bound by really, really sensible but very tight rules in terms of what we can do and the amount of risk that we are able to take. And for instance, in terms of our assets, making sure that we get the most value for the charity, which sometimes means that in a decision between, well, you know, who do you partner with or who do you kind of use your assets for, actually there's a kind of financial consideration as well. So I think there is some thought needs to be given to that. And I think in some ways, in the spirit of having to think about lots of things about the way organisations function post-COVID, then a bit of a thinking about the role of trustees, the governance, the rules around charity governance would be really, really welcome, actually.
Erica, I just wanted to throw that back to you and just really find out a bit more about the clients that you're working with and whether you're seeing a need for them to actually sort of look at the way they're working on the board and maybe organisations working more closely together and how that looks.
The unbelievable commitment of some boards during this crisis, they really have had to have a completely different role. It hasn't been turning up every quarter. It's been emails and decisions on a weekly basis. And it's been a scary place for many boards as well. And I've been really impressed with both boards that I sit on, but also throughout the sector and with clients, of just how committed people have been. I was thinking also when Jim was speaking about how one of the real difficulties about being a trustee is that you dip in, and maybe during the crisis, some of us have dipped in more, but you dip in and you dip out, and you very much come from your background. And so you get into a groove, the way that you think about things, and you know what you know. And something that the pandemic has taught me is that a lot of organisations have really had to change at pace, and throw out the old strategy. And where your trustees are stuck in a groove, it really helps if they can be flexible and open to other ways of working. And I certainly have resolved as a trustee to not just come to board meetings with my own knowledge and hinterland, but to be really open to learning about new ways of working, listening to everyone around the table. So that's one thing that's come out of the pandemic that's been really good.
I think that's really important, the feedback from, you know, around the table, as you said. I just wondered what you both thought of how the relationship with service users and other groups who are involved in using the sort of organisation's services have been improved over pandemic, or, you know, have there been any kind of great examples of organisations actually reaching out to the people that they serve to listen more and to find out what they need through the last year?
Great question, actually. As many of us have, I've been involved in a lot of conversations about recovery and a lot of conversations with funders and local authorities and other parts of London government and beyond. And everyone understands the narrative that there's been a hugely disproportionate impact on some communities, and the people who were in the worst situations and face the most difficulties of like things like food security or poor housing have been hugely affected. It's a good thing that everybody gets that. I still don't think the voices of those people have been sufficiently heard in terms of shaping the agenda. We had an event last week actually where we've been working for the last 9 months with groups across the community in East London. And the challenges of doing this stuff online are significant. If you reach out to people and you're willing to listen to them, you can make it work. And it felt like we really did. And we had around 50 people in the end, telling their pandemic stories and saying, okay, this is what we've gone through, this is what needs to change. And it was the brilliant thing about it is they weren't doing it with a kind of negative adversarial, oh, everything's wrong point of view. They were doing it with a really genuine, this has been our experience. We don't want other people to go through this. We want things to be better. We need to think about extending universal credit. We need to think about support for families. We need to think about better housing. We need to think about opportunities to look after children. Doing it in a way that only the kind of experience of people who've been through those kind of things can really share. Our very strong determination to really firm up our commitment in our strategy going forward, that we must be led by the community around us. The answers to the systemic challenges around poverty and inequality that we're dealing with actually are going to come from the communities. Of course, it means that government and local authorities and business and others do need to change things, but the way of doing that is much more about involving and engaging with the communities around us. And it feels like people are beginning to listen to that. And the response to our report last week was really positive, and many other organizations are doing really good work in that space. So if we can get that sense that people within communities can have a say and can have a better chance to influence how things are going to be, then I think, again, that's another positive thing that might emerge from this.
In the mental health sector and the charities working in that space, firstly, how heartening has been to see a lot of funding come in from the public or from individuals or organisations into that space, because, you know, it has been such a struggle for many people. And to really think about how to service their beneficiaries in so many different ways, including in the work environment, you know, something I think a lot of us have shared during this is that we've seen so many colleagues suffer in the work environment. And so I've definitely seen that with the mental health charities, just really thinking about how they can reach out to people and tailor the services to them. And in a completely different sector, in the cultural sector, one positive of this idea, this thought that maybe some of the cultural buildings won't always be open or might not be visited as much, is that there is now a rush to digitalise. And what that means is that they will be able to reach some people who don't feel comfortable going to a gallery or are too far away or don't feel comfortable going to the theatre and haven't been since school. Yet they are happy, or they might interact with an app that has great theatrical content, for example. And then we might see a democratisation of culture. And if that comes out of this, and I know so many boards and so many organisations are really focused on that, then it will be a good thing, not least for diversity.
I think that's a really interesting outcome from the past year, just how people have become creative with using social media and, you know, sort of looking into digital strategy. Just going back to, Jim, your outreach to communities, how was that actually done, and how did you ensure that there was equity involved throughout the process?
I think one of the key challenges when organisations say, oh, yes, we listen to the community around you, is well, how do you do that? How do you make sure it's not just the same voices saying the same things that might always be said, and you're genuinely kind of getting out? And I suppose that's one of the advantages that organisations that are genuinely rooted within communities have. We're not sending people out with clipboards to find people. We provide community services already, albeit now online during the pandemic. And we also provide debt advice and legal advice and have a youth program and have older people's services, and all of these kind of things are a great front end to make sure that we're connecting with the communities around us. And obviously it's really important those services are inclusive and are reaching out to people. And we use a lot of local volunteers. We're fortunate we've got a very diverse staff group with a lot of different kind of languages and a lot of different connections within the group. So we've got a network, if you like, of people that we can reach out to. Some of it comes back to just being willing to listen and ask questions. And by providing training and support to some of those people from the community, to think of themselves not just as kind of user of a debt advice service, but actually someone who can make change and somebody who is a researcher themselves. And by giving them the skills and the kind of ideas to go out and design a questionnaire for themselves and talk to their neighbours, then you can have a really great inclusive process whereby it's not just us who are having to look for people. Actually, the community themselves, it's a kind of self-generating of content and self-generating of insights, and they create the stories for themselves. The challenge is it takes a long time, and it takes a lot of sessions, and it takes a lot to get people who don't feel confident and who probably feel that their voices have never really been listened to before or they've never been asked stuff before. So you have to spend a lot of time with them and with each other in groups. And it was a really fascinating experiment to be able to do it online, you know, because it's sometimes it's much easier to do those kind of things in people's homes, in community spaces, in those kind of physical locations where people feel comfortable with it. And actually doing those things online took longer. We were really pleased at how people responded and how people wanted to get involved. And I say, we're not the only organization who does this. There's really lots of really good examples of people engaging with communities, and we're able to bring the group online to meet with MPs and peers who make up the all-party groups on Universal Credit and on food banks. Power of ordinary people from East London, if you like, being in that environment and talking direct about their experience to MPs and peers was incredibly strong, incredibly powerful. And that kind of thing will have made an impact in how the government and parliament in general thinks about how it works with people. So there's some real positives to build on, I think.
That's really exciting to hear that that's happening. I'm just wondering how we capture that so that it continues and the sector continues to kind of build on those experiences. And I mean, is there much sharing across the organisations that you're working with, Jim, to make sure that new ventures and different ways of working are embedded in?
And I think that's the challenge for all of us, isn't it? That, you know, there's been really hard things to deal with, but there have been some positives. And I think particularly the way that, say, funders have responded, they've been incredibly thoughtful, incredibly quick, very, very collaborative with each other. I really hope that stuff continues. I really hope that the risk aversion or whatever, or the kind of form filling and things like that, not that they're not important, but they're, you know, they sometimes dominate too much. And funders have done a brilliant job. And it's the same with employers as well. In fact, we had a really good experience in a summer last year, and when every organization, rightly, you know, in our sector anyway, was having to look at itself in relation to diversity, and particularly race and racial justice, because that was clearly both because of the impact of COVID, but more visibly in terms of Black Lives Matter and what was happening in America, and the realization that these structural inequalities hadn't gone away and people needed to talk about them and needed to reflect in their organizations. And we just, as well as doing some work within our own organization to challenge ourselves, which was incredibly important, we did some work with some law firms actually who were really, really keen, even in the midst of the pandemic, to think how can they be better, and thinking specifically about how could they create opportunities for young Black men and women to get into law as a profession. And so set up between them with us this Champions project, which is about mentoring young people from, you know, from different backgrounds, specifically young Black men and young Black women, to go into the law profession. And it's a small thing, but it's incredibly important that those kind of things are happening. And we shouldn't just think of those as, oh, that was a great idea last year, right, let's move on to something else. Actually, let's try and embed and scale up and grow and support this stuff, because if we don't support the good stuff, then the challenges will just overwhelm us, I think.
And I know, Erica, you've talked about engaging with different audiences, and I just wondered if how that might be kind of captured with the sectors and the organisations that you work with.
I think it's about being really rigorous, actually, about collecting that data and the feedback and the trends. I've worked with an organisation called UNITAS for many years, and I also sit on that board, and they have done a huge amount of work in the criminal justice sector, really with people in danger of being or already in the criminal justice sector, young people working and being taken out of their normal environments and spending time with artists and art practitioners to have experiences and to create work, often over a summer period. So that's just one of their projects. But the thing that has made that all worthwhile is that our CEO, right from the beginning, said the difference with this particular project is that we are going to collect all of the data and be completely rigorous about that. And I think there's so many parallels that can be drawn across different sectors around that, and around capturing things like diversity, but also just experience and who's coming over the threshold. And I remember thinking at the beginning of that process, when that project started, which was probably a decade ago, that we were putting too much into capturing that and recording it. But it was only 5 years in that we saw some of the really positive trends around changes in unemployment or education. And so I'm now a complete convert. And I think as a result of the pandemic, we should do that, and we should capture that data and be rigorous about it.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point about, you know, capturing data and just actually tracking what's going on. We've talked about the sector takeaways. I just wondered whether you could share maybe one or two personal takeaways from this in relation to collaboration. I know, Erica, you said a bit about listening to people around the table, but just one or two lessons that you feel that have really hit you over the last year and that you're hoping to use in future.
I don't want to end on a negative note, but I did want to mention something about commissioning and the commissioning landscape and collaboration. A lot of it isn't negative, a lot of it is positive. And obviously, as a lawyer, often advising on collaboration, I do a huge amount of positive work with commissioners. But one thing that has really struck me over the last few months is that the commissioning framework, and part of that is the legal framework, but it's also just the practice, is sometimes not helpful to a good end result. So without naming names, you know, some of the kind of big public sector commissioning bodies, like at the invitation to tender stage, so even before you've won any money or even had an indication that you might be in the running, you'll be expected to form a consortium or a collaboration, get to grips with a 100-page contract, do due diligence with other parties, nominate a lead partner that really has to carry the risk of all of the other parties, because the commissioners often only want to be contracting with one party, and then to put in place suitable subcontracts or sub-agreements with all of the other parties in the consortium. And often that is expected or is really the right thing to do before the submission of the tender. Well, that can be prohibitively expensive. And that whole model of long contract, lots of due diligence, lead partner, then push the risk down as much as you can, is not really a collaborative model. I mean, it stops it from being a partnership. And I understand why it's there. I do understand it. And you know, possibly if I was advising the commissioners, I'd tell them to do it in that tried and tested way. But it does two things. Firstly, it favours the larger organisations, the ones that can afford legal advice and who have done it before. So then as the smaller organisations, you get pushed into the minor collaborative partner, which may or may not get more of a run deal. And secondly, it isn't a partnership then. You know, it sort of mimics the supply chain. And I think that's probably wrong, or it just needs to be relaxed and flexible. And maybe it's about us all accepting that that model may be appropriate sometimes, but it really won't be all the time. So I just wanted to mention that as an aspirational point.
Yeah, thanks, Erica. That's really great. Jim, did you have anything to say in response?
And I think I'd agree with that as well. And there's a real risk sometimes that charities, even not just commissioners, but charities who run partnership programs and services can, you know, and with the best intentions and with looking at huge amount of need and huge amount of kind of work that there is to do, can slip into that mindset of saying, oh, no, it's kind of command and control rather than genuinely collaborative working. So I agree with you. That is a challenge. And I think that relates to my wider personal reflection, which is just, if I didn't really know this already, I certainly do now, that, you know, everybody's lives are very different, and the circumstances that, whether in within an organization, that your team are facing, actually people have had to deal with so much over this year. And for my expectation, oh, it's okay, we can just have another Zoom meeting about that, or find that piece of work will get done, when actually people have been trying to juggle ill relatives or homeschooling or people being furloughed or all those kind of things. It's been a bit of a reality check of people's lives. And I think that's the same with partnership working, that you as an organisation or a funder might assume that, okay, well, this organisation's well equipped, it said it can do this piece of work, if those three partners come together, everything will be fine. And actually the reality is many organisations have been really struggling for cash flow, organisations have had people off sick, organisations have had people on furlough. You know, the world isn't simple. And I think understanding of that, and tolerance, I suppose, and it's certainly not tolerance of failure, but it's tolerance that things might not be perfect. Perfect is the enemy of the good in some ways, that it's been incredibly hard. It's going to be very hard for the next, at least next 6 months, I would imagine, for organisations to get themselves back on an even footing. And I think a little bit of space to allow us to adapt. And that doesn't shouldn't and it can't let us off the hook. There is a lot of need and we have to be responding to that need, whether that's in the cultural sector or social justice or poverty or whatever it might be. But it does mean that we have to really, really respect different positions within partnerships and within organisations. And I think we can do that. I think the reason people are in our sector is because they care about people generally. And I think this has been a real demonstration of that over the last year. And I think we need to continue that mentality.
Thanks, Jim. Erica, any final thoughts?
I was just thinking about everything that Jim said, and I totally agree. We need to cut ourselves and our fellow organisations some slack and appreciate that it's going to take a bit of time to come back. So, yeah, that really resonated with me.
Thanks so much, Erica and Jim, for sharing your insights today. I look forward to seeing how the examples of positive change over the next year pan out and beyond.
Thanks for listening. You can find more resources, including the full Positive Change report, at bateswells.co.uk.